So tonight's talk. I give two regular talks a year. A couple weeks ago, I gave one on the five training precepts. When meditation is not enough, which was the title of the talk. And it went into mindfulness in everyday life and how the Buddha set that up, how we could pay attention to our lives as we maneuver around. My second talk that I give almost once a year is on Maranasati. And Maranasati is Pali for sati is mindfulness of, marana is death. So the Buddha said there were three subjects that were suitable for everyone to consider and reflect upon. And the three, first, Anapanasati. Anybody remember what that is?
Breath.
Very good. That's right. Mindfulness of breathing. So that's our foundation of meditation, is actually being aware of our breathing and going back to that again and again. Anapanasati. The second one, anybody want to hazard a guess what the second one was? He said appropriate for everyone. I bet a lot of you know it right now. You're just not letting it come up. It's metta. Metta. Metta is appropriate for everyone. Wishing boundless friendliness and goodwill to everybody. How's that ever not appropriate? It's always appropriate. We should be practicing that all the time. And the third one is Maranasati, mindfulness of death. So this is our entire life that he's talking about. Breathing, our gratitude and kindness to others, and then our own deaths. And this is the one most of us don't pay attention to. We don't pay attention to in our society. Yet, we are absolutely fascinated by it. And how do we know we're fascinated by it? Okay, here's some statistics. An average American child will see 200,000 violent acts and 16,000 murders on TV by age 18. Now, that doesn't include video games. So we're fascinated by it. But when we see death in this arena, it becomes a cartoon. It's not real. It's entertainment. And I'm going to go into this later, it's a way of keeping it at a distance. Keeping it as a cartoon and as an entertainment means it doesn't happen to me. It's out there. So the Buddha talked about delusion. I think our attitude towards death is probably our biggest delusion. First of all, thinking it's not going to happen to me. How many people have said, if I die, if I die, what is this if? There's no if. You're going to die. Everyone's going to die. Every person in this room is going to die. Everybody. And yet it is not something, it's not considered a pleasant topic. It's something to be avoided. And then conversely, we're fascinated with death. As long as we can keep it at a distance. I was looking up books on death and after death, just seeing how many there are. And the books on, here were some of the titles, Heaven is for Real, Proof of Heaven, Flight to Heaven, 455 books on Goodreads are about after-death experience, dying and after-death experiences. Again, it's entertaining, but it's entertaining. It's not real. It also creates a sense of permanency, a sense that, yeah, there's an afterlife. There's definitely an afterlife, and I'm going to keep going on forever. Who knows if there's an afterlife? Who's come back and told us there's an afterlife? Nobody that I know of has come back and given us a report, and I'll go into that in a little bit. On the other hand, we are also repulsed by death. So how are we repulsed by death? Can you think of some of the ways that we keep it at a distance, real death?
The body rots.
Well, we don't want to see that, do we?
Right.
No. Okay, Mary?
We don't like to see animals eat each other in nature.
That's right. We'll probably turn that off. That's disgusting. Don't want to see that. Yeah?
In a strange sense, like nursing homes.
That, I think, is the best example. Nursing homes put people away where we don't have to deal with this. Let's not watch them die. You know, and my mother was in a nursing home. She died a year ago. And she had dementia. And when she died, I found it very interesting, the whole process, because people came in to take the body, but they quickly looked in the hall to make sure no one was around. They didn't want any of the residents to see this. And I remember thinking, these people are in their 80s, 90s. They don't think they're going to die. I mean, we have to hide the fact that a body is going out. But that's our attitude. We have to keep it hidden and quickly get rid of that. Yeah.
Maybe some of the how people want to hide the signs of aging, maybe in some cases that's not wanting to acknowledge that.
That's a wonderful example. Everything that we can do, I mean, look at the youth industry. Look at the emphasis on youth in our culture to stay looking as young as possible. Don't you dare have wrinkles. Don't let that body sag. Do whatever you can to keep youthful looking. We are a youth-oriented culture, and it's a losing game. We're not going to win at playing at this youth culture. Every one of us is going to have wrinkles and die. You know, get over it. This is the way it is. The other reason we keep death hidden, it is our biggest fear. It's our biggest fear. And even if you don't think it's your biggest fear, it is. Social psychologists and psychologists, they've done so many studies, and underlying so many of our actions, which I will be going into in a minute, is the underlying fear of death and moving away from it, you know, in whatever way we can. So Laura and Rich and I, and maybe some other people in here on the study group, and one of the things that Tony Bernhard, who heads it, talked about was terror management theory last week. It happens to be a topic that I'm interested in because I've taught a Year to Live class for 3 years, and this always comes up. Terror management theory is the theory that what underlies so much of our psychological yearnings and pinings and the way we do things is our fear of death. And so they went around testing and proving it. And it was developed over 20 years ago by social psychologist Biko Anolio. Does everybody know who Biko Anolio is? Well, I know some of you do. He's a very well-known, he's a German monk. He's a translator, he's a deep meditator, he's also a person who does a ton of research on the original teachings. And he is very much a proponent of terror management theory because he said it coincides very nicely with what the Buddha taught about our own delusion about facing death. So, how did this come about? Well, humans, unlike other animals, we know we're going to die. We might not like it, and we might use all kinds of mechanisms to avoid it, but we know we're going to die. So terror management theory goes into how we cope. And I really like how it coincides with Buddhist philosophy. The biggest way we do this, we deny our own mortality. And what I had said earlier, if I die, that's, you know, that's just a a turn of phrase, but I think it says a lot. If I die. We really don't believe this is going to happen to us. I've read studies where even people who are very close to death believe that they're going to get out of this somehow. Somehow they're going to be the ones who escape this. And none of us do. So terror management theory goes into how we cope with this. And these are ways of becoming immortal. We're looking for ways to stay permanent. The Buddha said our biggest source of suffering is what? Impermanence. You know, the impermanence of ourself, impermanence of those we love, impermanence of the world around us. It's our biggest source of problems. And so we look to be immortal, and that's what terror management theory says. So here's some of the examples they give of what we do to create immortality for ourselves. We defend our cultural views more strongly, and I think one of the best examples of that is let's make America great again. This is defending a cultural view. This is creating a sense of this goes on beyond just me. This is about more than just me. I am so important that this is what has to take place. We are more punitive to who people we consider who are moral transgressors. See this obviously doing so much prison work. People punished for some absurdly ridiculous quote crimes unquote. Three strikes fortunately is no longer happening. But you know, three marijuana convictions and you're in for life? This is punitive. This is a way of I'm better than you, and I'm going to make sure that you know it. And I'm sticking around with my values and my way of being. We're more aggressive towards others, including support for wars. This is another way of maintaining our own immortality. We identify more with members of our own group, rating our group as superior. And this group mentality, again, enhances ourselves. It's more than just me. I have more going on. I'm living on through this group. This is interesting. It shows people express it through an interest in close relationships and a heightened desire to have children. Well, that would make sense. How many people have said, I want my genes passed on? I want something of myself to go on. This is just us looking to be immortal. They also say we distance ourselves from other animals, such as rating animals as less capable of thoughts and emotions. And the last one is we become more religious. We become more religious and believe in supernatural things. Also, we can push that impermanence away. So Buddha's approach, he was pretty much saying the same thing, not in this contemporary language, but yeah, this is our biggest fear. And we do whatever we can to keep that at bay. This is our biggest delusion. By the way, does anybody know our second biggest fear?
Public speaking.
That's it. Got it. That's exactly it. Actually, I think it's the biggest fear, but I think the Buddha got it right. So, three teachings that I think the Buddha put forth, which are most valuable to us in dealing with this fear of death. And the first one is Maranasati Sutta. So the Maranasati Sutta, remember, Maranasati means mindfulness of death. He is actually saying, and the terror management theory says exactly the same thing. To get over this, you have it come into your life and you become familiar with it. You become familiar with it. So the Maranasati Sutta, I'm going to read a very small portion of it. So on one occasion, the Buddha asked several of his monks, "How often do you contemplate death?" And one replied, "I contemplate death every day." And the Buddha said, "Not good enough." And another said, "I contemplate death with each mouthful I eat during a meal." And the Buddha said, "Not good enough." And the third monk said, "I contemplate death with each inhalation and exhalation." And he said, "That's what you should be doing. That's your practice." Now, obviously, we can't really do this all the time. That's all we'd be doing. But I think the point is that, well, Laura brought up, and I'll be talking a little bit about this, the five recollections. Who was here for Laura's talk on the five recollections? So a couple of you, good. So the five recollections are what the Buddha said we should all be practicing on a daily basis. The five recollections are simply, I am of the nature to age. I have not gone beyond aging. I am of the nature to experience ill health. I have not gone beyond sickness. I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond death. All that is mine, beloved, and pleasing will become otherwise, will become separated from me. I am the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, support and abided by my karma. All that my karma is, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. That is a simple recollection that we should be reciting every single day. It's a way to become familiar with and not afraid of death. That also enables us to be with people who are dying. How many people, somebody's dying, and I don't know how many times I've heard this, I don't know what to say. You know, I'm afraid I'll say something wrong. I don't want to go over there. You know what? You don't have to do anything. You just have to be comfortable with death and be a presence. That's it. Because nothing you say is going to bring anybody any comfort, but your presence being there, just being willing to be there and be comfortable with death, is huge. It's huge. Anyway, so the Marana Sati, and then Satipatthana Sutta. This is the basis of our practice here, the four foundations of mindfulness. The very first foundation, and I was telling Jacqueline and Les at an introduction to meditation, the very first foundation is mindfulness of the body. And there are six body contemplations. And one of them is mindfulness of the body decaying. So in the Buddha's time, he actually told his monks, and I hope, hopefully nuns, but they just say monks, but we'll say monks and nuns, to go to the charnel grounds, this is a cemetery, and sit with a decaying body. Actually sit with it and watch it decay. There's nine contemplations for decay. They go into it into that much detail. And to be comfortable with that, because this is what you will be doing. Your body is not going to last but 80, 90, hopefully 100 years. And then it will decay too. And get comfortable with that. And then, as I mentioned, the five recollections. When we get comfortable with death, and a lot of people say this, oh good, if I get totally comfortable with death, that means I won't grieve anymore. Is that what it means? Does it mean you'll never grieve again? You're not going to be sad when somebody dies? Of course you're going to grieve. You're a human being. That only makes sense. But you will know it as grief. You will not know it as my world is ending. Everything is awful. Why am I being punished? And this is a big one. Why am I being punished? No, it's a natural law. It's what happens. We die, our loved ones die, our pets die. Which brings me to, because I just happened to have breakfast this morning with a friend whose dog is in a bad way. And we were talking about death. And fortunately, this person is a very dedicated practitioner, and she is grieving, but she also is completely accepting and will be there for this animal till the very end. That's all we can do. Even the Buddha, when his two favorite disciples, his two right-hand people, Moggallana and Satyaputta, died, he said, it is as if the sun and the moon have gone out of the sky. It doesn't mean you don't grieve. It means you know you're grieving. So here's a poem by Mary Oliver, and it's on her dog Percy, who had died. And I love the way she grieves. Well, I'm sure everybody loves Mary Oliver, but I think this is just so poignant. And this is after her dog had died. The first time Percy came back, he was not sailing on a cloud. He was loafing along the sand as though he had come a great way. "Percy," I cried out, and reached out to him, those white curls. But he was unreachable. As music is present, yet you can't touch it. "Yes, it's all different," he said. "You're going to be very surprised." But I wasn't thinking of that. I only wanted to hold him. "Listen," he said, "I miss that too. And now you'll be telling stories of my coming back, and they won't be false, and they won't be true either, but they'll be real." And then, as he used to, he said, "Let's go." And we walked down the beach together. I think that's a beautiful way of grieving. You know, wonderful memories that you have, and knowing this is life. This is what happens. So why do we do this? Okay, Satipatthana Sutta, the cemetery contemplations, Maranasati, they lead us away from suffering. This whole practice is leading us away from suffering. Being comfortable with death leads us away from suffering. It almost sounds counterintuitive, but it isn't. It makes sense. Anything that you let into your life that you're comfortable with is no longer fearful. So it almost, I was looking at why does this work? I love thinking of these things. I love just contemplating, why does this work? And I know it does work. For one thing, we are letting go of our own self-identity for a little bit. We're allowing death and grief to come in. And it's not about me. It's about the process. We're just being. You know, just like I said in our meditation tonight, can you just be for a little bit? Instead of going into everything, just be. Just be with what's taking place. When we allow death to be part of our lives, we develop a lot of gratitude. Now, in my Year to Live group, and those of you who have been in it, and I know there's a couple of you, one of the books I assigned people to read was called 365 Days of Thank Yous. Anybody remember that book? I've mentioned it a couple times here. It's one of my favorite books. It's not a Buddhist book. It's just a great book. So, very briefly, it's by a man named John Kralik, and he is a real person. He's a lawyer. And he went through a very, very bad time. He went through a time where he considered suicide. And it was on a New Year's Day that he decided he was, and I hope I'm getting the story right, but I believe he's going to throw himself off a hill in L.A. And he, on New Year's Day, was climbing up the hill and fully intended on doing this. He was going through a divorce. He had his business was kaput, all kinds of horrible things were happening. So he's going to off himself. And as he's going up the hill, he started thinking, you know, but before I die, I should really write a thank you note to my friend so-and-so who was so helpful, you know, during this period of my life. And you know, my daughter, you know, she's really sweet. Okay, before I die, I'm going to write a couple thank you notes, then I'll die. So he went back down and he wrote a thank you note to his good friend. As I recall, I think that was the first one he wrote. And what he found was this depression lifted a little bit. He said, you know, I'm not going to off myself today. I'll wait till tomorrow. I'll write one more thank you note. So he wrote another thank you note and he found he felt even better. Mm-hmm. Then he decided somewhere along the line he would spend a year writing thank you notes and he'll kill himself after a year. So every day for 365 days he wrote a thank you note to somebody. He started running out of people to write thank you notes to, so he would write thank you notes, and this is the one that touched me. He went into Starbucks, and there was a young woman in there who was very sweet and kind to him, and he wrote her a thank you note, just quickly, you know, at the table, and he gave it to her, and before he could leave, she stopped him, and she said, I've been working here for a couple years, and nobody has ever thanked me. Thank you so much for acknowledging me. And he said his heart just blew open. He no longer wanted to die. He was so grateful for living when he just saw all that he had going for him and all the people who had been important in his life. And I think that's what happens when we accept that we are going to die. We can start looking at who's important? Who's been helpful? Who do we need to thank? What do we need to change in our lives? Another reason I think Maranasati, mindfulness of death, is important is our meditation itself can serve as a practice for death. Meditation itself, where the self drops away when we practice enough where it's peaceful and it's okay and we recognize this might be what it's like when we die. And what's wrong with this? Nothing to be afraid of. Nothing to be afraid of. Okay, so the next topic we're always fascinated with. Well, before I go on, does anybody have any comments or questions or anything they want to share?
I was just thinking when you were talking about, you know, examples. My daughter's an RN now. She's been working just for like a year and a half. And that people in the health profession who are right, you know, have death in front of them all the time, that so many of them don't take good care of themselves, mm-hmm. you know, or that they, that just is always surprising to me. Like those, so many nurses that smoke, and it's like it can't happen to me kind of thing. It's like this defensive denial that there's going to be the result that everybody else gets.
Well, that's a really good example of having it right in front of you, and yet still it's not me.
It may be because it's right in front of you.
Maybe.
I've always found that.
Yeah.
And I don't know if interesting is the right word, but it's like, why would you do that? You know better.
Yeah.
And smoking in particular. It's,
yeah.
It makes mm-hmm. sense.
Thank you, Maria.
I mentioned that I've just gotten back from being on retreat, and a couple things occur to me about the subject of grief. One is that our society usually runs pretty fast, and grief is inconvenient. Mm-hmm. You often don't have time. Somehow don't have time. And I find that retreat, and it used to kind of make me pull back a little bit, but I realized that the piece about grief that's always interested me too is that when your heart opens, you wouldn't be grieving if you didn't love.
Right.
So there's the metta piece.
Right.
But to allow yourself to take the time to take, you know, when you're talking about taking care of yourself, it's very clean. It feels very different in the body than pushing away
exactly.
and telling yourself you're not supposed to do that.
Exactly.
It feels
exactly.
very, very different.
There's almost, this is the wrong word, but I don't know any words in English that describe it, but there's almost a joy in grief experience it completely. Heart opening, cleansing, I think you described it best, but it's a different place when you actually allow it to happen and don't push it away.
It's like I did it, you know, that thing about Mary Oliver's dog. I mean, mm-hmm. I got this experience I had with a cat back. And it's immediate. It's an immediate experience of what it was like to be with that person.
Right.
Or that situation. I mean, it's a real gift.
I totally agree. I think that's why the Buddha emphasized this practice so much.
Yeah.
Because it's what we're all going to experience with people in our lives, animals in our lives, and ourselves. So, what happens next? Anybody ever think about that? What happens? Actually, the Buddha said, don't think about it. Don't go there. And we all do. We do it constantly. We can't help ourselves. That's just the way we're made up. Now I'm going to go into contemporary. There is a project that is being funded by the Templeton Foundation. Maybe some of you have heard it. It's called the Immortality Project. UC Riverside got $5 million from the Templeton Foundation to look into immortality. And here are some of the questions that they were funded. Whether and in what forms people survive or could survive bodily death. Whether and to what extent persons' beliefs about immortality influence their behavior, attitudes, and character. Why and how persons dispose to believe in post-mortem survival, and whether it is in some sense irrational to desire immortality. So I've been going on their website. They post essays, and it's actually very interesting stuff. But as the Buddha said, this is not something we should become obsessed with. I think his advice was, if you live your life with virtuous conduct, with no regret, the rest will take care of itself. And I find that very reassuring. But we still think about it. And Buddhism and the afterlife, this has been an ongoing debate in especially Western Buddhist circles forever. Traditional Buddhists believe in rebirth. Western Buddhists, not sure, I don't know, maybe not, maybe. Secular Buddhists believe rebirth is defined as the beginning and end of each breath. So we are constantly being reborn. I think traditionalists would agree with that, but they think it goes beyond that to life after life. You know, right?
I thought the teaching was that there are three ways we do that. One is when we sleep, and one is with the breath, and one is when the body dies.
Not the Theravadan point of view, but that's the Tibetan point of view. Yeah. And a lot of Theravadan teachers, and I'm going to go into this, a lot of Theravadan teachers gear towards Tibetan practice because they go into death and dying in a lot, well, in detail. You know, Theravadan, very little. This was brought up at our study group too. Ajahn Amaro went to a conference, and for some reason he was there on birth control, and I'm not quite sure why a monk would be, you know, discussing birth control. But he had said Buddhists are not so concerned about birth control, but controlling rebirth, and that is the traditional Theravada way of looking at it. I think it's really interesting because, you know, in Tibetan practice, they talk about bardo, that in-between state between death and rebirth. I had assumed Theravadan practitioners, Orthodox Theravadan practitioners, did not believe it. But then I stumbled on this paper by Ajahn Sujato, who is affiliated with Ajahn Brahm in Australia. If you don't know it, just take my word for it, he is. And he wrote a very scholarly paper, and I also find it's interesting. Buddha said, don't pay attention to this, and then he wrote this very scholarly paper, which was called Rebirth in the In-Between State in Early Buddhism. And in the very earliest teachings, in the Pali Canon, they said there was this in-between state, and it was, what was it called? Antarabhava, and antara means between and Bapa means becoming. And the karmic residue would reside there for a while before taking rebirth, according to Orthodox views. This later was dismissed in the Visuddhimagga, which I'm not going to go into, but that was the original teaching, very similar to Tibetan teachings. The difference was, in Tibetan teachings, it is believed for, and in all Mahayana teachings, for 49 days after the death of a person, you can influence their rebirth through prayer, through chanting, through dedicating merit. Theravadan Orthodox don't believe that. They believe your actions in this lifetime dictate your rebirth. Yeah.
That's, when I asked Lama Alodra about, you know, there's no self and there's been what goes on, and his answer has puzzled me for years. I think it's really interesting to think about. He said, unfulfilled strands of desire.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I just think that's real interesting, which goes along with what you're saying and why the interest in karma and mm-hmm. these habits, these right. predispositions we have, that they have volition.
Right.
And that they influence what yeah. what you want to become.
Well, this Andhra Bhava place is exactly that, and Ajahn Sujato describes it as clinging that has not been released. So instead of an instant rebirth, it was believed that you stay in this clinging state, but your rebirth is already destined by your actions. So you can take it or leave it. You know, this is an Orthodox point of view. Western Buddhists, not so much, but some people believe it, some don't. None of us know. None of us know exactly what's going to happen. But one thing that we all do agree on, all lineages agree on, is when someone dies, you or someone you are close to, you want them to die with a positive state of mind, and you remind them of the good works and the good things they have done in their life. Regardless of their religious affiliation or no religious affiliation, that's what you want to do. I know when my mother was dying, I spent the day just conjuring up every cool thing that she had done, everything I could think of, and she was no longer really cognizant, but I wanted her to die hearing all the positive things that she had done. And that's what we can do. You know, if we're present with death, we're okay with that, and we can be there for our loved ones and for ourselves. And when we die, we want to have that as well, which means through meditation, we start developing this positive state of mind. Thich Nhat Hanh said, the mind you die with is the last thought of this life, something to think about. So you would need to have a pretty good meditative practice to control the mind and have a positive state of mind as you die. So my own thoughts. I always finish up with my own thoughts, and we're almost done. So this acceptance of death, Marana Sati, five recollections, and I know for a couple of you, it's my daily practice. I recite the five recollections every day, as I know Laura does, Terry does. It's made a huge difference. It's funny how just words, just make you comfortable. And it's no longer a scary thing. It's just the way life is. It's a natural process. My second thought, not Buddhist, but just what has occurred to me over my lifetime, is Einstein said that energy can never be destroyed. So what does that mean? I don't know.
But he also said all it does is change form.
It changes form. But what does that mean? I don't know.
What does it change into?
But I'm inclined to think something happens because Einstein said so. Einstein said that energy cannot be destroyed. Yay, Einstein, right. I read a book years ago, you know, and I was struggling with all kinds of things and eventually ended up in Buddhism. I read this book on, I was going into all kinds of quantum physics and everything, thinking, you know, maybe they had some answers. And one of them was on the 10 dimensions. It was written by a physicist. And he had said, we can know three, but we can't know the other seven. He said, but they're there, they're mathematically proven. But we're incapable of knowing them with our limited minds. And I think that explains a lot. I like to leave it at that. We have no idea what takes place. Yeah.
I like the proof of the radio and the stations, you know, and what you're tuned to. And you know, there's all these vibrations out there, and just as right. where you put the dial, what you're.
That's right.
What's existing there?
What is existing? Exactly. So I'd also like to leave you with, and Terry has talked about this, and she's talked about starting one, deaf cafes. Anybody heard of deaf cafes?
No.
Barbara, you have?
No, I was going to say they have them in Berkeley. I was in the Heavenly Messengers program, and some say they have them all over the country, but some folks in Berkeley started them.
There's been one in Auburn, too. I don't know if it's still going on.
What is it?
Death Cafe is a place for people to gather and talk openly about death, their fears, their understanding, what they want done when they die, things that, you know, because we repress death so much, our families do too, and I know I've talked to my children about my own death. What do you always go there for? Well, because I'm going to die. That's why I go there. And when I did a year to live group, that was one of the biggest problems. People say, I can't talk to my children about this.
Another question on the year to live. Initially, when I heard that, I assumed that everybody in that was going to die. So it's not that. What is it?
It was pretending you were going to die in a year, and how would you change your life?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and it's a powerful practice, a very powerful practice. Yeah.
One thing I found valuable is being a hospice volunteer.
Yes.
You get to go and hang out with people who are dying. So I recommend that to anyone who's interested.
Except, and I've got a friend who was a hospice volunteer, and she was wonderful and compassionate, but she said, but I never thought it was going to happen to me. I was being there for someone else. Is that true with you, or can you visualize you will be in this state as well?
Well, I did it mostly because I think there's good ways to die and bad ways to die, and I thought if I stayed with people, I would get a sense of the different ways people die.
Right.
So it was almost like training for death for me. I wasn't thinking about me dying soon, but that was kind of the orientation I had.
Great. Yeah, hospice is wonderful. Thank you. Linda, yeah.
Well, I'm just curious. I mean, you're speaking to it, I know, in some sense, but I think something like 60 to 80% of people, and I'm not sure, that's a pretty big range, report having some sort of apparent contact, whether it's visual, auditory, sensory, with people who have died.
Mm-hmm.
And in my own life, I've had a number of very profound experiences with people who have died.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really convincing to me that there is continuing even personality. And certainly some kind of spiritual existence that continues. So does that fit with what I understand is the Buddhist, I mean, what I've understood is that in Buddhist thinking that there might be a sort of impersonal strain that goes on, or you're talking about, you know, desire, threads of desire that are still, you know, sort of frustrated and refusing to let go, presumably.
Yeah.
Can you kind of address that from the standpoint of Buddhist teaching?
No. I'm not acquainted enough with any of it. There's all different schools of thought.
Mm-hmm.
I can read one thing. Well, Rich, do you have anything to add to that? it's not a topic.
Same as you.
Huh?
Same as you.
It's not a topic that is generally discussed in Buddhist circles. In fact, I was surprised to find this paper by Ajahn Sujato. I'll tell you very, very briefly. He goes into a 5th century encyclopedia of Buddhist knowledge that talks about this in-between state and visible. He said it's only visible to creatures of similar spiritual accomplishments and that it can be seen by others. Now, this is an old, 5th century text. So I know many people have talked about visitation. I've had that too. It inclines me to think that there's something else, but I don't know. I don't know if I'm hallucinating. I don't know. I have no idea. And there is no, other than Tibetan teachings, I know of nothing that is in the Pali Canon. Yeah, if you read the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, it's a great book, and it goes into great detail on all these subjects. And a lot of Theravadan teachers use the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying as a source of comfort for people who are dying. Yeah.
Hi.
Yes.
Hi, everyone. I'm Ramon. And when you first introduced yourself, first you talked about the prison project, so that always grabs my attention because I work in a prison. I'm a psychologist. And then you talked about sort of death as a discussion of topic for the evening, and those two were tied together for me today. Interestingly enough, we had a late admission this afternoon for a patient who has a delusional disorder, so he came in with some paranoid delusions. He's not taking his psychotropic medications, but he's also living with HIV, and he isn't taking his HIV meds intentionally. And as we sort of go through our admission process, all the different disciplines ask their questions, and I had an opportunity to sort of interview him and asked him why he didn't want to take his meds. And he said because he believed in reincarnation. And he was almost sort of like toying with this, though. He wasn't taking it very seriously. And I interpreted sort of part of his condition as being ill unnecessarily because of his choice to not take his meds. And so I asked him, what are your interests? What do you, what gives you joy? What brings you happiness? And there's not a lot that brings happiness to people in prison. So that sometimes it's not an easy question to answer, but almost always it's reading. Reading books, and he was interested in reading books on Islam and on Buddhism. And so, this is only my fourth time here, and I'm not trained in this particular tradition. I came for the meditative practice, and that's what keeps bringing me back, and I think at some point, I'll start learning Buddha teachings and start to sort of incorporate that more into my life. I'm sure it's already there, I just don't know it. But, so when you asked for books on Buddhism, I don't know where this information came. I guess it just sort of through osmosis from being in this group. But I said, one of the precepts is to do no harm, and I think that means to yourself as well.
Yes, it does.
Oh, good. I got it right. So I got it right. That's good. And he found that really intriguing. And this is somebody who has a break from reality, but who has these glimpses of insight, and he found that intriguing. And so at least I feel like I have a thread sort of to pull with him that I'm going to be meeting with him more on one-on-one, and we'll see how that goes.
Many blessings to you.
Thank you. And just the topic, I just feel really acquainted with this topic, just like this gentleman was saying here. I think a lot of my life experiences, I've been near death, not my own, other people's. I've worked in my late teens, early 20s in a retirement home that it was probably one of my favorite jobs ever. And a lot of our residents died during the time that I was there. In my early 20s and mid 20s, a lot of my friends in the gay community were dying from HIV. And I was fortunate enough to be able to be present during compassionate assisted suicides when before it was legal in California, which I'm really grateful that now it's legal. I live in a house that borders East Lawn Cemetery.
My favorite walking place.
Mine too.
I'll see you there.
I'm here every day with my little dog buddy. I love that, and I love cemeteries in general. I just find them very, very peaceful places to be. And then just the last thing I'll share is that my mother is living with stage 4 breast cancer, and she's been diagnosed going on almost 2 years now. There's no cure. There was never a cure offered, and she understood that from the beginning. She's had a radical mastectomy. She continues to take medications that feel like they're killing her, but she's got to keep taking. Well, she's choosing to keep taking them, and I'm glad she is. Mm-hmm. And I know we're not supposed to have our plans on that. I just turned it on just briefly to share this. I gave her a book for Christmas. It was Oliver Sacks' book, Gratitude.
Yes. That's a wonderful book.
So I gave it to her at Christmas, mind you, and I just got this a few days ago. I'm going to share it. I finally read Oliver Sacks' Gratitude. I loved it. I don't really understand why I couldn't or didn't want to read this book. Maybe it had to do with living while dying, and I felt like I was already doing that. Once I gave into it, I learned that seeing life while dying through Dr. Sack's eyes, and in parentheses, yes, even his cancerous-ridden eyes, was so similar to my own feelings and experiences, yet also different. I felt empathy for Dr. Sack's, but not pity. I knew that he felt the same for those of us that would find ourselves in his position. He was being truthful, and if there's anything that the living while dying crowd needs, it's the truth. It's so hard for us to find. Thank you, my wonderful son, for the rarest gift. I wouldn't have found it on my own. Thank
you. Ramon, thank you so much for sharing that. There's nothing more to say other than just a whole lot of gratitude. And I think
thank
with
you
that,
for the space.
Thank you. I think Ramon wraps up the evening, and thank you all for coming.